Hello, Rock and Roll Rebels, and welcome to another episode of Ramble On with Rosie. We are here to discuss more of the story of Rory. Rory Gallagher, the phenomenal Irish blues guitarist, who, in celebration of it being Irish Heritage Month, I have been discussing all month long, and you can't get much more Irish than the Irish Tour 74, which is both a concert film and a soundtrack to said film that was released as, an album at the time. We'll be discussing both. I'll mainly be discussing the DVD that I have of the film and what's in it, both the audio commentary by Rory's brother Donal and his bass player Gary McAvoy, or Jerry McAvoy. I always get thrown off when I see Jerry spelt with a G instead of a J, and I want to say it's Gary. So if I make that mistake again, I apologize. But Jerry McAvoy, who was Rory's bass player for a long time, and Rory's brother Donal have an audio commentary and the bonus features that I watch and is really good. If you have the DVD and haven't watched it, definitely recommend. But moving on from there, the music was recorded with Ronnie Lane's mobile recording studio, which has as on its pedigree of places it's played. It was used to record Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti and Bad Company's debut album at Headley Grange. It also recorded the second Bad Company album, Straight Shooter. It was used to record The Who's Who by the Numbers and Quadrophenia and several other albums. Those are just the biggies that most people have in their record collection and are aware of. But, so it was definitely the machine to have. If I remember correctly from the commentary, they couldn't use it to record in Belfast, which was the third location. It was the footage and the audio were recorded in Dublin and in Cork and in Belfast, but I believe, if I remember correctly, they just used the soundboard to record in Belfast because they could not ensure the recording studio to play in the absolutely bombed and ravaged city in Northern Ireland, because the troubles were at some of their worst and most violent at this point in Belfast. So, if the fact that Rory was playing Belfast at all is no small miracle, because nobody else was. Like, there were native acts, like, that were from Belfast or nearby, and maybe from the Republic of Ireland as well, that would play Belfast. But an internationally acclaimed act was not, they were barely playing Ireland at all, and they certainly were not playing Belfast. Like, that was a thing. I mean, it's repeated in almost anything you read about this concert, both the, DVD as well as the recording of the audio and the album. They're like, no one played Belfast at this time. I mean, nobody famous. And you may be like, well, Rory's not that famous, but bear in mind, Rory's already been in the pretty successful band of Taste that toured America, and they didn't just tour America, they opened for Cream on Cream's farewell tour, and then they opened for Blind Faith on Blind Faith's only tour. So that's two super groups with Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker in them. Like, that's nothing to be sneezed at for being an opening act. And Rory had toured America as a solo artist by now. Like, when I discussed his radio appearance in the Cleveland Calling episode that I talked about, that's before this. So he's been on radio shows in America as a solo act before now. So he's, I mean, he's not Led Zeppelin, but he's not to be sneezed at. He's known, and no known artists were playing Belfast at this point in Irish history, because it was like I was saying, it was the troubles were at some of their most violent at this point in that city. In fact, in the DVD, you'll see concert footage. I mean, you'll see footage of the city while some of the concerts playing in the background. And there's busted out windows and, a heavy police force I mean, they even confiscated a camera that they were using to record the concert with, the police, the British police did of the Belfast concert. But on the other hand, you've also had 10 bombs go off the day before Rory played, which made almost everybody assume that Rory was going to cancel, because I mean, that would be sort of the reasonable thing to do for your own personal safety, would just be to not play and not risk you and your audience potentially being harmed. But Rory went ahead and played. I cannot remember where, and I will not take it as verifiable fact, but I think I recall hearing an interview about this concert where somebody inferred that not Rory, but one of the other band members may have had connections to make sure that there was not any bombing going off that particular evening. Somebody in the band or who knew the band might have had IRA connections. It was inferred. I cannot remember the source. I think it was an interview with Jerry McAvoy, sorry. But don't hold me to it. I just remember hearing that at one point. I was like, well, that might make sense. Otherwise, But anyways, so that's like the environment that Rory was playing in a town that he had lived in for a while. And it's just, it's really kind of astonishing, especially because back around the time he was in Taste, he had literally gotten beaten up in Belfast for his accent because somebody came up and asked him for a cigarette, and when he was like, I don't smoke, they could tell that he had a southern accent, well, Ireland southern, not American southern, and so they were about to start beat up on him, and then like other people who had been in the audience in the gig at the little, pub or wherever he'd just played, maybe it was a little bigger than a pub, small theater, but wherever the venue was, people who had been in the audience, like, came out and came to his aid and told the other people where to get off. They're like, no, you don't bring your politics into our music. Like, this is a sacred place, probably more sacred than a church, almost, or almost equal to, where it's just like, no, we don't do that here. We'll go blow things up and fight each other and get involved in hostilities someplace else at some other time. But it's about the music, so do not be beating up on our musician. So it was, refreshing. And that was just a few years before, him playing this Irish tour, which you've got a really sort of moving and heartwarming kind of tale. There was a reporter for a Belfast paper who attended the concert, and apparently right after Rory like took stage and the audience had calmed down enough that they weren't jumping and screaming, the very next thing they did was they all in unison, like the whole hall, raised their hands with the peace sign, which was just really powerful, given the situation that Belfast was in at that time. It wasn't, in fact, you can see in the concert footage, like it's kind of going on while the first song, which is Walk on Hot Coals, plays, but you can see a few audience members still raising their hands with the peace gesture, which is powerful stuff in a semi-war-torn city. Like, it's not a war zone, but it kind of felt and looked like a war zone in some ways. It's, was sort of semi-civil war for several decades. It's really hard to quite, put a clean label on the troubles in Ireland at that time. Thank goodness they're over, though. But yeah, so like I was saying, the film opens with Walk on Hot Coals, which there's, like some footage from the concert, especially you can see the keyboardist Lou Martin absolutely going after it on that piano, and you can have no trouble believing it when Donal says in the audio commentary that he frequently had to replace keys on Lou's keyboard. You can totally see how some keys would get broken with his just ferocious playing. And then you get some good energy between Rory and his bass player, Jerry McAvoy. They have like this whole fun synchronized bounce thing that they're doing, and they're just setting the place on fire in a good way, unlike the way that they thought it might end up when they played the gig. And it's great. You get the ambidextrous drummer, Rod Diath. He has his moments, and it's just a great introduction to the band visually and musically. It is interspersed with like footage from like the countryside and, you know, the sea down by Cork. I can't remember if the footage of the footage of the audience would be from the Belfast concert, because you've got the people throwing the peace sign and whatnot, but not all the footage is from Belfast. Some of it is from the Cork and Dublin gigs. So yeah, that's how the film sort of kicks off. By the time you're getting to the latter part of the song, when you see the audience, there's literally a bunch of them bouncing around like it's a, you know, it's this big bouncing mass that you'd expect at a punk rock concert, almost more than a blues folk artist. Like the energy in the audience is almost rivaling Rory's energy, which is of course, you know, dialed to 11 as usual. And it's funny, you've got this bouncing semi-punk rock looking audience, not in their attire, but in their behavior, bouncing up and down as enthusiastically as humanly possible. And it's 1974. Like, punk certainly hasn't happened in Britain yet. It's barely rumbling in America. Like, the Ramones are maybe playing the CBGB by this point. So it's kind of funny that like the energy's there, and then the outlet for it is going, you know, the more universal outlet for it is going to come in a few years. It's like foreshadowing. But anyways, the concert really kicks off proper, like the proper concert film part of it, where it's not just an introduction with a song and occasional snippets of footage, but like the proper film and concert kicks off with Tattooed Lady, which is, you know, just a classic Rory song. You know, it's got some really good songwriting to it. I could have honestly mentioned it in last week's episode, but I was trying to keep it, you know, to a reasonable length. And the lyrics, I mean, I always like the lyrics to Tattooed Lady because they're very, like, storytelling and pull you in. And, you also get this really cool backstage interview snippet, which there's a few of those throughout the film, which is why it's worth having the DVD, or at least renting the film, or however you watch your films, then instead of watching the free but abridged version that was on YouTube last time I checked. But it's very cool for the specifically this one sequence that happens after Tattooed Lady, where he's discussing the, you know, various sounds and styles of bottleneck and slide guitar playing. Like, it's really informative. I was like, you're getting educated by a phenomenal guitar player. You can understand why, you know, Brian May was so impacted by Rory taking the time to tell him how to, you know, improve his technique and playing and sound and what to do. Because Rory is really meticulous about, you know, these sorts of things when you see him in the interview, so you can only imagine he was that way, if not more so, with an individual who was, you know, trying to improve their own playing. And then the next song is Who's That Coming, and you really get to see the joy that Rory gives in his guitar playing. I'd have to say it's maybe one of the most outstanding things about Rory as a guitar player is, unlike so many other guitar players who are like persistently grimacing, he's joyful. Even if the song isn't always a happy song, he usually smiles a few times throughout playing it. Like, it's like, even though you can definitely tell he feels every note and is totally into it, whether it's a happy song or a slow song or an upbeat song or a sad song, you can tell that he's really into what he's playing and is feeling it, but also you can tell that he's enjoying playing and enjoying the rush of music and being on stage, 'cause he smiles, I mean, way more than Jimmy Page, more definitely more than Jeff Beck. You know, he more than Clapton, who's usually pretty neutral. The only guitar player I can think of who even comes close to being as happy and animated as they're playing their guitar, would probably be Stevie Ray Vaughan, who usually whenever I'm trying to tell somebody about Rory, I use Stevie as a point of reference, because not a lot of people, hardly anybody I know knows who Rory is, but most people, especially living in Texas, know who Stevie Ray Vaughan is. And so I'm like, I sort of be like, well, he's like Stevie Ray, but he's not, you know, but sort of use that as a point of reference, because I can't really be like, oh, you know, think about Alvin Lee. That, like, Alvin who? And I'm like, never mind. Because all anybody knows by 10 years after is I'd Love to Change the World. And Alvin's more bluesy stuff was more after that. But that's a side tangent on how difficult it is to find a point of reference for Rory, which has a lot to do with the fact that Rory is a blues guitarist, but he's not. Rory is his own musical genre in of himself. Because nothing sounds straight like one particular genre usually when he's playing. I won't say nothing, but a lot of his songs are like a bit of, you know, jazz, a bit of blues, a bit of folk, all wrapped together, but not in an obvious way where it's like, oh, that's obviously a bit of folk and that's obviously a bit of jazz. You're more like, this is just Rory, and this is one of the ways that Rory sounds, but it's not really, it doesn't really sound like anything else. He just has one of the most original and unique artists possibly ever. And maybe that has a lot to do with the fact, as I talk about later, and he mentions in an interview when he's in a music store, he had no desire to release singles or be a pop act. He literally was just in it for the music. In fact, to his brother's frustration, he would never release a single. So there was to be no popular success, and that's just how he wanted it. Which meant he was free to sound like whatever he wanted to sound like without trying to fit a formula. Which, you know, is probably a big factor in why he has such a unique and original sound. And his, you know, his craftsmanship is just, it's unlike anything else. It doesn't sound like any other artist, hence why it's so hard to find a point of reference when you're trying to introduce somebody to him. But yeah, so that side tangent about Rory's marvelous, you know, uniqueness aside. And back to the concert, the next song is A Million Miles Away, which I did discuss last week when I was discussing his songwriting, because it's really good, so I won't bother doing that here. I will discuss, however, that this song in the concert absolutely showcases Rory's clean but mean sound that he can do with his guitar. It's really good. Like, it's clean, but it's so rich and bluesy and mean and beautiful all at the same time. I mean, this live performance absolutely outclasses the studio version, and the studio version isn't bad. And his show-stopping spirit, like, we go from Million Miles Away, which is sad and reflective and just got some really gutsy guitar work in it, to Rory as the absolutely standalone showstopper, because the next song is Going to My Hometown, and he literally is rocking the place apart with just a mandolin. I mean, Rod Diath, the drummer's keeping a pretty basic beat to him on the drums. It's mainly to keep the, you know, keep beats so the audience has something to clap to. But Rory absolutely, like, burns the house down with just a mandolin. Like, just him and his instrument and a little bit of, you know, drumming to keep a beat. And it's just so energetic, which you wouldn't think somebody playing a mandolin would be that way, but it definitely is when Rory does it. Then there's another interview snippet in the film where he's talking about, it's actually the same one I was talking about earlier, where he's talking about his just doesn't want any stardom, his avoidance of it. He doesn't want to be the person dealing with the Rolls-Royce and the paparazzi. And he literally has this very charming quote of going, "I just enjoy rambling the streets." Like he says, he's like, you know, he straight out says it. He's like, "I don't mind fans coming up and, you know, wanting to talk to me and stuff." But he's like, "I don't want to have to, like, you know, run for cover. I like to be able to walk around freely," which is a pretty sane way to be, you know. He's got the wisdom to realize that too much fame can be a bad thing. And it that's so that's it's a really good interlude. It's like up there with the slide guitar interview part, where it's just, you know, really cool to see him interacting, because he's in a music store, and then there's also an interaction with a fan, and it's just really wholesome, as most Rory things are. And then the next song, which is Cradle Rock, there's a bit of audience footage where you see some fan, who it may be, we'll never know, miming Rory's fretting hand. And you can very much guess that this is some, you know, aspiring guitarist who's trying to remember the patterns that Rory's, you know, fingers are on the fretboard so he can go home and practice it. I'm not just pulling this out of nowhere either, because I've been going through Bruce Springsteen's autobiography again, and that's exactly what he did when he was learning guitar, was he'd go to concerts, even if it was just the school dances, and watch the guitarist and try to see what he was doing, and then run home and emulate that. And with Rory being a national hero, practically, especially for playing in Belfast, you know, the fact that he'd play their city when he's big time famous and all, you can definitely imagine any aspiring guitarist, you know, doing anything to see him emulate it as much as they could. So I thought that was a really cool piece of, you know, film work on the part of whoever had the camera to pick that up. It adds another layer of richness to the film. And then you also get a backstage scene of jamming between Rory and the keyboardist Lou Martin, and then an interview part where Rory is discussing his 1930s National guitar, which they're sometimes called a resonator or a dobro. Dobro was a brand of resonator guitars that sort of was competing with National brand, and then they joined. But the fun part about this guitar is that there's an interesting story on its acquisition. So, if I am remembering the story correctly, Rory told Clapton that he was looking for a, you know, specific, I believe for a resonator guitar, but he was looking for a specific guitar. So Clapton hooked him up with this kid whose name was John P. Hammond, and said kid happens to be the kid of John H. Hammond, probably the most legendary record producer and talent scout in history. Like, he helped hire people of color to break down the racial barriers. He signed Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, to name just a couple of the artists that he signed. So, like, this kid's dad is somebody, even though he, you know, didn't grow up with his dad that much. And so that this is who helps Rory navigate a music store in New York. And he thinks he's gonna, you know, because John Hammond Jr. is over here thinking that, you know, oh yeah, the shopkeeper is gonna try and take advantage of this, you know, poor green Irishman. So I'll negotiate the deal for this, you know, resonator guitar that he found. And so he goes up and tells the lady, you know, he wants to buy it for $50. And she's sort of like, "Well, I want 500 for it." And then Rory comes over and talks to her in his charming, soft-spoken little Irish accent, and gets the guitar for $50. So here Hammond Jr. was thinking he was going to get Rory a good deal. It backfires, but Rory is so, if you know, self-effacing and charming and humble, that the lady ends up selling it to him on his charm for $50. And I was like, oh, the irony. It was a fun little antidote that I read, and I was like, I have to share this because it's lovely and beautiful, and you know, who wouldn't sell this, you know, shy, soft-spoken young man a guitar for whatever price he wanted to pay for it? There's an alternate version that Jerry McAvoy shared about how Rory acquired it in the South, but there was less details there, so I'm gonna take the Hammond story over the McAvoy story, but you know, it's hard to tell. It's been a few decades, so they both may have some merit, but Jerry could only remember a few details, so I'm gonna take the more detailed version, plus it's funnier. Moving on from that to As the Crow Flies, which is definitely a way to move. Rory is playing this, you know, he's playing, and while he's playing, they intersperse it with scenes of Blarney Castle, which is just outside of Cork, where he grew up. So, as Donal says in the audio commentary, they went a few times as, you know, kids growing up. He couldn't remember if Rory kissed the Blarney Stone. Donal was like, "I think I kissed it like a half a dozen times because of the various trips we went on." But during As the Crow Flies, Rory plays some lush slide guitar. So good. And then also some really soulful harmonica. That should not be as hard of a sentence to say as it was. But anyways, and the playing in both of the instruments is, it's a lot more nuanced and graceful sounding, in a way than like most when you typically think of blues harmonica and slide guitar. It's really kind of, you know, not to use a trite term, but pretty. And sort of an uncommon way to hear it played in the context of a blues song. So, really well done, and yet again circles back to Rory being his own genre of music, you know, because everything that he does sounds like him pretty much, even if it's somebody else's song, which As the Crow Flies is, in fact, written by someone that's not Rory. I can't remember the artist who wrote it off the top of my head, but it's not a Rory track. Somebody else wrote it. However, the next track, Hands Off, is another song by Rory, and I could have definitely discussed it last week in the songwriting episode, because I love the uniqueness of the perspective of the narrative. Because it's not often you have a song where the male lead in the song is telling a woman to back off, especially for the reason of they're loyal to their girl. It's like the line in Hands Off is my girl needs some consideration, and then he's repeating, you know, hands off, and the various other lines where he's basically telling this other woman, hey, back off, I'm taken, and therefore I'm not interested, and I'm not the one for you, so move on. I'm like, I can't quite think of another song that takes that particular tack when it comes to, you know, love triangles. I'm like, well done, you loyal dude. Well done. Not a common take in a song. And musically, the song just is glorious. It screams along, and it's so groovy. It's got this absolutely great groovy guitar break that I love. And it's a concert standout, both visually and musically, especially when you see Rory and Jerry rocking out. It's a lot of fun to watch. Yet again, Rory is such a joy, you know, you can tell the joy of his playing when he plays, so he's definitely an artist who, like, the visual aspect of his playing, you know, if you can watch some concert footage, is a good thing to have, because it's really good. I love watching it. Then there's the, that's sort of, it's not exactly the total end of the concert, but it kind of is, because after that song, there's a bunch of screams for the encore from the Belfast audience and some backstage discussions. And I'm not sure, I can't say this verifiably, but I feel like I read it or heard it that, like, they couldn't go back on to do the encores because, like, you know, everybody was still really tense about, you know, being in Belfast and the potential of bombs and whatnot. In fact, when after they're screaming for the encores and you're backstage, you get Donal, who's sort of discussing the situation and his relief that the predictions of bombings hadn't happened, you know, especially with the 10 bombs that had went off the night before. And I mean, to me, I'm just impressed because, I mean, Donal's younger than Rory. So you think of this, you know, lad in his early 20s who's managing his internationally famous brother as he tours through a semi-war-torn country. You know, it's pretty impressive the amount of responsibility riding on Donald, which is why in a later scene and that's at an after party in Cork, it's really nice to see Donald just relaxing and downing a pint and, like, looking vaguely, you know, contented, tired, and buzzed, and a lot less stressed than he looks at the Belfast backstage. And the whole band looks that way, where they're just that sort of tired but relaxed and relieved state, and they're having a bit of a tipsy sing-song with, you know, friends and musical comrades, and it's a really nice scene. Rory looks like he's very happy and possibly a little toasted. They all kind of look like they're happy and toasted, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you have footage of Donald literally guzzling a whole pint of most likely Guinness. There's lots of Guinness drinking in the backstage sequences, too. But yeah, moving on from the imbibing of alcohol, there's another interview snippet where Rory's discussing his preference for writing while he's in Ireland. Yeah, so he'll have, like, ideas, but he won't flesh them out till he gets home. Like, he'll take his notebook and then he'll, you know, think out songs once he gets back to Ireland. And then after that, it's back to the action with the absolute scorching barn burner that is Bullfrog Blues, which while William Harris wrote it, not Rory, Rory completely owns Bullfrog Blues. No one else should even try to perform it. Like, this is one, if not the signature song that Rory has. It's, like, from the way he just, like, belts out, you know, the beginning when he's like, well, did you ever... Sorry, I will not try to imitate it accurately. But he's just, you know, he hypes up the whole song before it even starts. And, like, Rory just owns Bullfrog Blues. Bullfrog... Ugh, why is Bullfrog such a hard word to say? Bullfrog Blues is just his. It's such a great song. And then when you watch it, one of the good aspects of seeing Rory play visually is you get to see that for the first few minutes of the song, Rory is not using his ring finger because it's got the metal slide on it. So he's doing all this fantastic, glorious playing that you would have no idea he didn't have the use of his four full, you know, the full use of all four of his fretting fingers. You know, if you were just listening to it and you're watching, you're like, oh my gosh, this sounds awesome, and you don't even have your whole hand to use. And then, you know, a couple minutes into the song, he does play the slide. And then also, a couple minutes after that, he has a string break. But yet again, if you didn't see it, you wouldn't know it. You'd just be listening and be like, this rocks out. I mean, I guarantee you probably people who were there and saw it didn't really notice it. It's like, there's some footage, I think it's at Austin City Limits, of Stevie Ray Vaughan playing through a broken string, and you wouldn't even realize it if you hadn't seen it, because they're just that good, and they keep the energy going. They're not, like, you know, disabled by their broken string. It's like, the show will go on, and the show will go on with such passion and energy that you won't even notice that something's going wrong. And so it's just, Bullfrog Blues is a great showcase for that, you know, Rory's guitar playing, and then you get Rod Diath positively pounding his drum kit to smithereens in a very precise way on his drum solo. And before the drum solo, you get Jerry McAvoy's really groovy bass solo. So it's sort of one of those songs like, you know, it's sort of one of those roll call songs where everybody gets their moment. Kind of like Rosalita at Bruce Springsteen concerts can be, where, like, you know, as everybody's names listed off, they get to showcase a bit of their skill, whether it's drumming or bass playing or piano playing. I can't remember exactly whether the keyboardist got a showcase moment in Bullfrog Blues or not, but he has other moments. They're all such talented musicians, and it's so sad that of the four of the band members, only Jerry McAvoy is left. The other two died in, like, 2011 and 2014-ish, around then. And, of course, Rory's been dead since the 90s. So I'm like, it's really sad. They're all gone. Everybody but Jerry, who has a I can't remember if it's called Band of Friends or something, but he has sort of a band that goes around, you know, playing Rory songs, and I think some other stuff too, that shows up at like the Rory festivals and stuff. Like the one I was going to go to in 2020 had 2020 not been what it was. But anyways, I still hold out that maybe I'll get to go sometime. But that's the concert. It's really good. Definitely worth watching. If you can't watch it, however, the 40th anniversary version has way more songs than were on the original one. So you can get like 40 songs practically from the Cork and Dublin and Belfast recordings and listen to those, which I highly recommend because they're phenomenal. And so y'all do that and, you know, do the usual, be kind to each other and rock on. And I will be back with more fun facts next week. They may, or I'm trying to figure out, do I talk about Rory some more, or do I talk about the Pogues with Joe Strummer, because that's become my latest obsession. Only next week's episode will tell, so check back in for that. In the meantime, y'all have a great week.